Support for NPR podcasts comes from Visa, offering the Visa Signature Card, featuring concierge services for travel, dining, and entertainment at visasignature.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For six decades, American policy in the Middle East was pretty clear. Go with the strong men and never mind the democratic niceties. Stability was what mattered. 4 years ago, George W. Bush declared an end to all that. Stability cannot be bought at the expense of liberty, he declared. The USA, he said, would now line up with democracy. But the angry Islamic democracy that has surged in Bush's time is not what the president had in mind. Hamas, Hezbollah, the Muslim Brotherhood, these have the political popularity. Washington calls them extremists, terrorists. So what now? Up next on Point, Islamic democracy and America's hard choices in the Middle East. Joining me first today from Washington is Ken Silverstein, Washington editor of Harper's Magazine. His article, Parties of God, the Bush Doctrine, and the Rise of Islamic Democracy, is Harper's cover story this month. Ken Silverstein, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
So what did George Bush expect when he called for democracy in the Middle East, and what did he get?
Well, I think in part he wasn't thinking a whole lot. He was making a speech that really had something to do with the Iraq War and the justification for the Iraq War. This was November of 2003, and the weapons of mass destruction hadn't been found, and so suddenly there was a lot of talk about the importance of democracy in the Middle East. And so he gave this widely praised speech in which he effectively repudiated 60 years of American foreign policy and said that the United States would no longer coddle dictatorships and authoritarian regimes in the Middle East, that it was time to really start getting serious about promoting democracy.
And reckless to accept the status quo. Reckless, he said, to keep on keeping on.
Exactly, and that we were undermining our own values and our own self-interest, in fact, because by coddling these dictatorships, we simply created political instability that might come back to haunt us. So we were going to do something about that and turn that all on its head.
Western nations excusing and accommodating the lack of freedom, he said, did nothing to make us safe. That's decades of policy right there, because in the long run, President Bush said, November 03, stability cannot be purchased at the expense of liberty. All right, so under duress, Iraq not going well, needs a new rationale, elaborates it pretty forcefully here. What emerges?
Yeah, well, unfortunately, for the administration, he did elaborate it rather forcefully, and then Condoleezza Rice subsequently reinforced it, and the record hasn't been nearly as encouraging. I mean, you've had a series of setbacks for democracy across the Middle East, particularly in countries which are our longtime and continued allies, such as Saudi Arabia, Egypt, and Jordan. So, you know, the Saudis don't even have an elected parliament. They have this very toothless consultative council, which is appointed, it's not elected. And, they show no signs of loosening up. The Mubarak regime held these very, very badly flawed parliamentary elections in which there was severe repression. But despite that, the Muslim Brotherhood and Islamic Party emerged as the most powerful opposition bloc. President Mubarak, who's ruled longer than many of the pharaohs, he's now up to 25 years, was reelected, and I put that in quotes, in a flawed vote. So you've had a series of setbacks, and other than a few pretty hollow proclamations on the part of the Bush administration, nothing really has been done. So the administration has periodically poo-pooed some of these setbacks, but hasn't taken any action. And in fact, those regimes clearly have determined that they can pretty much get away with the old practices, and they don't have a whole lot to worry about.
So the old authoritarians back to their authoritarian ways, sometimes in Egypt with a vengeance lately, and to the extent that democracy has blossomed, you write, it's not really in a form that the Bush administration wants to embrace.
No, I mean, one of the questions I pose in the piece is, I say that in this part of the world, we frequently ask if the Islamic world is ready for democracy, and there's a suggestion that they're just not quite mature enough or ready for it, when in fact a real question we might be asking is whether the West is ready for Islamic democracy. Because for more than the past decade, there's been a real flowering of Islamic political parties across the Middle East. There are dozens of these parties. They've competed in elections. They usually with the rules very, very badly stacked against them. Mm. And yet they've accepted the results of those elections without violence. And they have, at least rhetorically, for the most part, adhered to or endorsed free speech, the rotation of power, people's right to petition their governments, demonstrations. And, of course, they have an interest in demanding those things because they're the outsiders.
But when you say they, you're talking about names that the Bush administration puts right in the terror camp, Hamas, Hezbollah, just for starters.
Yeah, I mean, some of these parties, those are the two parties that are, I suppose, more controversial because they maintained armed wings. And yet, while in this country we simply identify them as terrorist organizations and nothing more, that's not the way they're looked at in the Middle East. And in fact, it's not the way they're looked at in most parts of the world, including good chunks of Western Europe, where they're not simply labeled as terrorist groups. Hamas and Hezbollah both have participated in democratic elections. They're political parties. They run vast social service networks. They do a lot. It's not just, they're deeply rooted in their cultures and societies in every way. And it's not just a bunch of people running around with guns and blowing things up, which is sort of the stereotypical image that we have in this country. They really are key players in their country's in their region's political systems.
Okay, this isn't just abstract. It's very here and right now. On the authoritarian front, we've got the report just out a couple days ago of Egypt throwing a 22-year-old blogger in prison for 4 years because of a posting online. I mean, I assume that's not considered terrorism. He's charged with criticizing President Hosni Mubarak, insulting Islam. So there's the authoritarian weight. On the other side, Hamas, of course, won a political election among Palestinians, rebuffed by the West, cut off from Western funds, strongly condemned by Israel because of its militant stance against Israel. Now, in the saddle with what's supposed to be the more moderate faction in Fatah, Israel still saying no to conversations there. And the United States now, Ken Silverstein, also still saying no. Are you saying the U.S. should just throw open its arms to what you call Islamic democracy, even when it's armed, even when it comes with terror in its wake, in its wings?
Well, I'm not saying throw open our arms, and I'm not in any way saying that I endorse every position taken by these Islamic parties. I mean, frankly, I'm a Western person. I'm very secular myself, and so their political agendas and ideologies are not, there's much that I disagree with. At the same time, I'm not Egyptian, I'm not Palestinian, and so what I think in a way of their ideology doesn't really matter a whole lot. I think it's very hypocritical, and you hear this repeatedly in the Middle East, for the United States to rhetorically suggest that what we really want is democracy, and then to simply shut out movements and groups who we don't approve of when they happen to win power. I mean, in the Palestinian elections, which the United States demanded and supported, in which was considered probably the freest vote ever held in the Middle East. You'd never see an election like that held in, our friendly governments in Egypt or Saudi Arabia. Mm. Hamas wins the election, and we instantly say, too bad. We're going to punish the voters for their choice, and we're going to cut off all aid. We're not going to even talk to the new government. We'll have nothing to do with you. And as I note in the piece, that's effectively the same message that al-Qaeda sends to the public in the Middle East. Ayman Zawahiri, bin Laden's deputy, has issued a series of videos and audio statements over the last few years in which he's condemned the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt, which, by the way, has renounced violence 30 years ago, mm-hmm. more than 30 years ago, mm-hmm. despite being the victim of repeated violence by the Mubarak regime.
Which we support with tremendous amounts, nearly $60 billion in the last several decades in aid.
$2 billion every year. So we talk about how all we care about is democracy, but as I said, we reject it when we don't like the outcome. Zawahiri issued several statements over the past couple of years, one attacking the Muslim Brotherhood, saying by participating in elections, it was playing the U.S. game, and attacking Hamas, too, as a sellout organization, and saying that jihad, not elections, were the way to liberate Palestine. So we basically are sending the very same message that al-Qaeda is, which is that democracy doesn't matter. It doesn't count. And if you vote for people we don't like, we won't recognize the outcome. I don't think that's very productive.
Do these groups meet your standard, meet a, I don't know, a textbook standard for democracies?
Well, I don't want to talk about what my standards are, but let me say that in terms of the fundamental basic parameters of democracy as we understand it in this country, their vision is not all that different in most cases. I mean, they have endorsed the idea of the rotation of power so that if we win, we don't win forever. We have to run in subsequent elections. We have to maintain our popularity to keep our hold on power. They have endorsed, you know, free campaignings, political demonstrations, as I said previously, petitioning the government. They've attacked corruption. They've talked about government accountability to citizens. So at the broad level, much of what they say is very similar to what we say in terms of the fundamental components of democracy. Does that mean that their vision is identical to ours? No, it doesn't. They have very different ideas about certain concepts such as individual rights. They're not, you know, they're not liberal Democrats in the Western sense.
I.e. individual rights subservient to the law of Islam.
They, you know, certainly they foresee, envision, and support a much more active role for religion in society than we do in this country. Although I should say that in some ways they actually espouse ideas that are very similar to those espoused by conservative religious groups in this country.
Ken Silverstein's been with us. He's Washington editor for Harper's Magazine. His cover story there, Parties of God, the Bush Doctrine, and the Rise of Islamic Democracy. We're going to hear from the region itself in just a couple of minutes. But first, the voice of President Bush here in a speech he gave March 2005. Here's President Bush hailing democracy blooming in the Middle East.
The victory of freedom in Iraq is strengthening a new ally in the war on terror and inspiring democratic reformers from Beirut to Tehran.
Inspiring democratic reformers from Beirut to Tehran. Ken Silverstein is with us in Washington. I want to go to Amman Jordan right now and Washington Post reporter Anthony Shadid, Middle East correspondent there. He's the author of Night Draws Near. He's been writing recently about exactly that, the democratic impulse in the Middle East. Anthony Shadid, thanks for being with us.
It's my pleasure.
Here we are, President Bush, fourth year of the Iraq War behind us. President Bush has tied it up with the call for democracy in the Middle East. You've recently reported from Egypt that the democratic movement there, if we can call it that, is anything but inspired right now. What's happened?
Well, you know, it's remarkable when you look at the arc of what's happened in Egypt, because there was a certain moment there, activism that grew out of certain work that was going on around the Palestinian uprising that was happening in Egypt. It turned into an anti-Mubarak movement to some degree, and in some ways it reflected what the Bush administration was hoping for, a secular movement, somewhat liberal, not the traditional religious opposition of the Muslim Brotherhood. That movement did have a moment of ferment, you know, through 2004 and 2005.
Yeah.
It's remarkable that as the Bush administration's pressure receded, which pretty much everyone agrees on, as the government became more assertive and in some ways brutal, it's pretty much left that movement in shambles at this point.
So that leaves the way open for Islamic democracy again in Egypt. Do you see a secular democratic movement in the Middle East as viable, or is Islamic democracy what the world, what Washington gets when it calls for democracy there?
Well, I think it's interesting, and it's a lot of what Ken Silverstein explored in his article recently in Harper's. There is, you know, a very traditional Islamic opposition in Egypt. It's generations old. It represents a very significant constituency inside Egypt. I think what's remarkable over maybe the past few years in Cairo and in the rest of the country is that you're starting to see some cooperation between that Islamic opposition and the more secular opposition. That's a new development. That hasn't happened, say, 10 years ago or 15 years ago. It's going to be interesting to see where that goes. Can the religious and secular oppositions actually cooperate, and to what degree does that, or to, you know, to what result that cooperation leads to? And it's still unclear. But I think you're seeing changes even within the Islamic opposition. You're seeing a certain flexibility. You're seeing a certain rethinking of traditional principles. And I think it's going to be very interesting to watch how that evolves.
And what about the American role now in that evolution, Anthony Shadid? You quote a demoralized opposition leader in Egypt saying, "The Americans now prefer stability over democracy." He goes on, "I will never trust them again."
Yeah, I think it's pretty clear that there's a deep disenchantment with U.S. policy at this point, not only in Egypt but in Lebanon as well and elsewhere in the Middle East. We're dealing with a Middle East today that is very unsettled, as unsettled as any time in, perhaps a generation. You have the traditional Israeli-Palestinian conflict that's been going on for a long time. Now you have, simmering civil wars elsewhere in Iraq and even in Lebanon. Egypt is in a period of stagnation again that rivals the stagnation it was going through 5 or 6 years ago. It's a very bleak moment in the Middle East right now, and I think faith in what the Americans want is probably an all-time low is probably too dramatic of a phrase to say, but there's deep disillusionment out there about what the United States had promised and now what it's trying to promote in the name of stability.
Do you see Washington warming up to conversations with Islamic political powers, with Hamas, with Hezbollah, any movement on that?
I think that's a good question, and I think that's something interesting to watch. You really don't. And I remember a conversation I had with a senior State Department person a couple of years ago in Egypt where they said that engaging the Muslim Brotherhood is a red line for them. They won't engage the Muslim Brotherhood. It's the same organization that probably represents anywhere from a third to a half of the Egyptian, electorate. It's difficult to see how you're going to lead to real democratic reform and real democratic change in a lot of these countries in places like Egypt and the Palestinian territories and Lebanon without some kind of engagement with the Islamic movement since they represent such large constituencies. But at this point, you really don't see any signal from the Americans that they're willing to engage them or have a desire to engage them.
Anthony Shadid, Middle East correspondent for The Washington Post. Always great hearing from you. Joining us today from Amman, Jordan. Anthony, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Let's go right on across the region now to Kuwait City, Kuwait. We're joined there by Augustus Richard Norton. He's professor of international relations and anthropology at Boston University, been living in Cairo for some months now, was an advisor to the Iraq Study Group. His new book coming out is Hezbollah, A Short History. He's a real expert on that front. Augustus Richard Norton. Richard Norton, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. It's very nice to be with you today.
Nice to have you. So Hezbollah is your particular area of expertise. It's, of course, very strong now in Lebanon. Is this the face of democracy in the Middle East? And if it is, does the United States need to talk with it or try and shut it down?
Well, Tom, I wonder if you'll let me comment on Egypt for a moment,
sure,
if you don't mind. And I'll answer your question. I've listened to both of the commenters who've been very interesting today. And I respect them both a lot. But I've been living in Egypt for the last 6 months. I only recently moved to Kuwait. Mm. And there are two comments I'd like to make. One is that Egyptians are very contemptuous of their own regime. They would like to have a freer political system. There's no question about that. But by the same token, I think if Egyptians had the opportunity to vote freely, they wouldn't necessarily vote for the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
One of the problems is that the regime's policy has made this this group basically the only show in town. The second thing is
deliberately. They've squashed the secular alternatives.
Mm-hmm. Deliberately. This is the regime strategy. And the other thing is, the U.S. Does have a position that it has the right to talk to members of the Muslim Brotherhood who are in Parliament. There are 88 of them in Parliament. Mm-hmm. I know this has been officially communicated to the Egyptian government, but I know also from very reliable sources that diplomats have not engaged in those contacts, which seems to me to be really foolish because we need to have a dialogue. We need to get straight in our own minds what these people stand for, and to talk to them about what we would expect from their participation in the political system.
But is the United States
dialogue is not going on?
Richard Norton, is the United States right now so I won't varnish it, just freaked out over Iraq that it's embracing Mubarak and never mind secular Democrats thrown in prison in Egypt? That's just too bad.
Well, I think that's a pretty fair statement. I think priority 1, 2, 3, and 4 in Washington right now is probably Iraq. Many people noticed in January, I was in Cairo at the time, that when Condoleezza Rice visited to talk to the foreign minister and to meet the president of Egypt and so on, she did not even mention the word democracy, reform. And in fact, the man who opposed Mubarak in the last presidential election, Ayman Nour, has been languishing in an Egyptian jail for more than a year now under very difficult circumstances. And on basically trumped-up charges, and the Secretary of State did not have time to even bring up the man's name in any public meeting in Egypt.
And this in a country we support with
about our priorities.
This in a country we support with billions in aid. Turn to Lebanon and Hezbollah. Very, very influential there. We saw what happened in its war with Israel last summer, but also, you know, lots of complaints that it uses its military force to throw its political weight around. Do you see it as a critical, as a credible democratic representative of its constituency in Lebanon? Should the U.S. be talking with Hezbollah?
Tom, let me put it this way. This is by the argument I make in the book. I mean, this is a Janus-faced organization. On the one hand, there's a militia component, and on the other hand, there's a real political party. Many Lebanese would agree probably the only real political party in Lebanon. What's happened, and I've been following this organization now for almost 30 years, and really following it before it existed, so to speak, what's happened is that you've had a migration of support amongst Lebanese Muslims, particularly Shia Muslims, in the direction of supporting Hezbollah. I was struck, I was in Lebanon until yesterday. I came back to Kuwait yesterday morning from South Lebanon, where I'd spent a week or so. I was struck by the number of people who I've known for many years. In some cases, these are people I held as babies in my arms in South Lebanon many, many years ago. People who have maintained a deliberate, if you will, neutrality in politics, who are now supporting Hezbollah. So this is a marked phenomenon. They're not doing it because they're buying into any kind of extreme ideology. They're doing it because they see this organization as a means by which they can basically play a better hand in politics.
So there we are, and what should we do? Augustus Richard Norton in Kuwait and Ken Silverstein in Washington. I'll turn to you on that, but let's hear from our listeners as well, if I may, from Toronto, Canada. Ed is calling. Hi, Ed. You're on the air. What do you think?
Hi. I respect the United States highly, but I feel so sad when I see over 3,000 troops now being just slaughtered. The Americans stand up for a philosophy, but really, they can't be the godfather of the whole world. Stay home, become isolationists, let these countries do whatever they want. But the next time they attack the United States directly, employ the call philosophy, hit them with full force, no mistakes make it, just like the Balkans. And don't lose any more lives, please, because these countries are too unstable, and I just don't want American lives lost anymore for Islamic philosophies, whatever. If they touch American people, and if their philosophy injures American people, yes, go at them full force.
But otherwise, stay out of it. Ed, thanks for that. Ken Silverstein, how about it? Is that an option for the United States?
Well, I agree with the sentiment that, you know, we need to distinguish between, and as I try to do this in this story, between Al-Qaeda, which is basically an organization that doesn't want to take part in the system. It wants to burn the system down. It has no stake. It doesn't even recognize the system of nation states. It wants to restore the Islamic Caliphate. And organizations like Hezbollah and Hamas, who I think have fundamentally local agendas, local desires, who are not trying to burn the system down. They have a stake in the system. As one of the officials I talked to about this said, they have an address. You know, Al-Qaeda doesn't have an address. So I think we really need to distinguish between organizations that are intent on doing harm to Americans and organizations that really are focused on what's going on in their own country and getting a stake in their own country. I think there's a significant difference. And right now, we really don't make that distinction. It's that we sort of lump these groups all together and just say we won't talk to any of them.
Richard Norton, but with everything that's rooted in the Middle East, I mean, the issues of geopolitical stability and oil and Israel, the caller says just stay out of it. Let them work it out. Can the U.S. stay out of it?
I think we have far too much at stake, honestly. And I think our allies have far too much at stake. And it sounds nice in theory, but I just have to respectfully disagree with Ed. I just don't think we have that option. And I think the I think we need to remember something that Anthony Shadid said a few moments ago when he was on the air from Jordan. And that is when the Bush administration began to elaborate a democratic agenda several years ago, there was a lot of excitement in many corners of the Middle East. So, you know, this question of reform and change and everything else, it's not the wrong question. It's a question of what our answer was, the execution. And our execution has just not been very good. I mean, this has just been a pitiful government in Washington to watch in terms of its Middle East policies, I'm afraid I have to say.
Well, we'll look at that. Roger's calling from Foxborough, Massachusetts. Roger, you're on the air.
Hi. My comment is that I see straight lines being drawn between a Democratic election and the United States being opposed to the results as being something that's unusual. The group that elected a group of people who are opposed to Israel, who are opposed to American policy, are living with the results. Basically, if...
You're talking about Palestinians voting in Hamas.
Correct. I mean, even Hitler was democratically elected in a flawed election, but it doesn't mean that the American people are wrong for not supporting what Hitler was doing. The Hamas, although not like Hitler, basically have a policy that is opposed to Israel and opposed to America. So how can you expect America to be pro the people who voted that group in?
Ken Silverstein, how do you respond to that view?
Well, you know, first, let me say that I find suicide bombings repugnant. Secondly, let me say that Hamas has not conducted a lot of terrorist attacks in recent times, particularly after winning the election. And third, let me say, at the risk of being provocative and angering a lot of people, that the problem when you start throwing out these charges is that there are a lot of aggrieved parties in the Middle East, and each party can point to atrocities committed by the other side. So I can tell you that Palestinians would certainly say in response to those comments that, well, Israel at one point elected Ariel Sharon. Ariel Sharon was clearly complicit in the slaughter of Palestinians at refugee camps in Lebanon in the 1980s at Sabra and Shatila, the Palestinian refugee camps there, where even an Israeli commission found that he had stood by, at minimum, he had stood by and allowed Christian militiamen allied with Israel to go into the camps and slaughter hundreds and hundreds of civilians. So every side is going to say, oh, the other side is illegitimate and we can't talk to them. And the problem is that you just don't get anywhere at that point, and that the only way to sort of break this deadlock is by parties coming together and trying to reach an agreement. You can't reach an agreement if you're not talking and if you're simply rejecting any communication.
Richard Norton, how about it? Our caller Roger says, look, just because they're elected doesn't mean the U.S. has to support them. Is that a view that the U.S. can effectively take over time, can successfully operate on over time, if so much of political power in this region is Islamic political power?
Well, first of all, let's go back to the elections amongst the Palestinians for a moment. The Israelis recommended to the U.S. that those elections be postponed. The Palestinian Authority, that is to say Mahmoud Abbas, recommended that the elections be postponed, and the Egyptians recommended the same thing. The Bush administration insisted on holding the elections. And under the circumstances, since they insisted on holding the elections, you have to say that their subsequent policy was a little bit strange.
Augustus Richard Norton has joined us from Kuwait City, Kuwait. He's been spending a lot of time in Cairo lately. His new book coming out soon, Hezbollah, A Short History. Ken Silverstein, Washington editor for Harper's Magazine, is with us. Parties of God is the headline of his cover story in Harper's. We're going to hear in just a moment directly from Israel, but let me go first to Frank in Arlington, Massachusetts. Frank, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I wanted to comment that Hamas and Hezbollah came into existence as a direct result of Israeli intransigence toward creating a Palestinian state. And while Israel continues to colonize the West Bank, and it's all in Jimmy Carter's book, but Israel is imposing impossible conditions on the Palestinians and then asking them for peace. Many of my Jewish friends will say to me, "There is a Palestinian state. It's in Jordan." And if we're going to take this attitude toward the Palestinians, there is not going to be a Palestinian state. Just get it on the table. That's what it's going to be like. And let's not try to demonize these people and to push them off the land and essentially do what Hitler was doing to the Jews, to these people, to get them off the land. Let's just say that's what we're doing, and try to find some kind of other solution to it. Anyways, that's my comment. And
Frank, we've got it. Let's get a response directly from Israel, if we may. On the air right now from Tel Aviv is Gidi Greenstein, president of the Reyut Institute, looking at long-term strategic support of the Israeli government. He's former secretary of the Israeli delegation for peace negotiations with the Palestinians in 1999 to 2001. Gidi Greenstein, thanks for being with us. Welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
I think you just heard that caller's perspective saying, look, his words, Israeli intransigence created Hamas and Hezbollah, they should be dealt with. How do you look at the rise of Islamic democracy, Gidi Greenstein?
I would say that it is a very long stretch to make the point that the establishment of Islamic groups on the Palestinian side is an outcome of Israeli policy. If you look all over the Arab world, you see a rise of Islamic groups, Shiite and Sunnis, and to say that it is an outcome of Israel's policy, it's a very, very hard point to establish. But I want to say that that this rise has to do with a much deeper trend within the Arab world, frustration with existing governments, frustration with the economic performance, and the ability of Islamic groups to take a real grassroots approach and to address the needs of the people in ways, of ordinary people, in ways that the established governments have not been able to do. To a similar effect, and that's a big, much bigger trend than the Israeli-Palestinian or the Israeli-Lebanese conflict.
So you're saying Hamas and Hezbollah are, to some extent, doing that at the grassroots level, providing that support. Where does that leave the United States, in your perspective, Gidi Greenstein? George Bush called for democracy. Now these groups have support, yet they have positions that are anathema to Israel and to many in the United States on some fronts. So should there be engagement anyway or stonewalling? What do you recommend?
The basic dilemma on the issue of democracy in the Middle East is between stability, which means continuing to work with the existing regimes within the existing political parameters on the one hand, or going for democracy, which inevitably would have meant a rise in the power of the Islamic groups. And what the Bush administration did was basically to go for democracy in favor of stability. And
As opposed to stability,
and the outcome is much higher instability across the region. And right now what we see is that the Bush administration is clearly pulling back from this agenda of democracy and tilting its center of gravity in favor of preserving stability and reestablishing stability in areas where the stability has been lost.
But are you saying that it's wrong for the United States to back democracy in the Middle East?
I'm not saying that it is wrong to back democracy. What I am saying is that democracy at the present state of the Middle East comes at the expense of stability. These are very, very long processes, and the fundamental mistake was that someone assumed that you could promote democracy without unleashing Islamist powers in the region.
But George Bush said long-term, if you don't have liberty, democracy, you're not going to have stability. It's an illusion to think otherwise, and he was prepared to wade into that. Everybody knew that. I presume they knew that wouldn't be easy or smooth.
You're right, and politics is there are no guarantees in politics. This is a very clear agenda. Some of the regimes here in the region are totally unacceptable in terms of their democratic performance, in terms of their transparency and accountability, the participation of women, and so on. So all of these things, the lack of free markets, all of these things are evident. This is a constant source of concern in terms of the long-term stability of the region. And balancing these considerations, there is an art. It's not a science. And the American policy in the region, for a variety of reasons, have led to much greater instability. And right now, I assume that what is going on and what we're seeing in Lebanon and in Syria and in Iraq and in other places is an attempt to recreate stability, to try to reestablish stability to the extent that this is possible.
But if you're a democracy activist sitting in prison in Egypt while the United States rebalances towards stability, that can't feel like much fun. Let me take a call from Charleston, South Carolina. William, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi, William.
Yes, I'm going to make a couple of points, but the heart of my point may come a little later, if just bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, I think when we talk about Islam and democracy, we may have a juxtaposed set of words. Islamic democracy then may just be an oxymoron. It just doesn't work. I do think what we have in the Mideast with these elections are shams. I think what we have is we have people who are forced to make certain decisions and certain votes, forced to make certain statements in polls that are impressed upon them by thugs, either theocratic or secular.
So and when you really see Hamas and Hezbollah, you're saying these election results aren't credible?
Of course not.
Mm-hmm.
Of course not. If you live in southern Lebanon and you have Hezbollah living all around you, and if someone finds out you vote for something other than Hezbollah, you're going to be hamburger.
So take us to your bottom line, William.
Say again?
Take us to your bottom line, then.
The bottom line is it takes a long time for the democratic process to work where you get people making a vote that represents their true values and their true wants and their true needs. What we're having is the imposition of the needs of a particular group, such as Hezbollah or Hamas, cast upon the people, and they have no option. Out of fear, they have no option.
William, we've got it. Richard Norton in Kuwait City, how do you respond to that? Islamic democracy equals an oxymoron, William says. Elections are shams. People are intimidated into voting for Hamas and Hezbollah. Therefore, the implication is the U.S. doesn't have to deal with this. It's not for real.
Well, that doesn't ring. His comment, unfortunately, doesn't ring true to me for the following reason. He cited South Lebanon. It's a region I know fairly well. And I would tell you that in South Lebanon, you can find all manner of political parties, including communist parties, nationalist parties, various Islamist parties, and so on. And there is competition. The fact of the matter is, however, that Hezbollah is very popular now in South Lebanon. The people feel, and it may sound ironical to us, but the people feel that this party gives them security. And the people in the South have felt the weight of occupation, we need to remember, for more than two decades. Let me quote an Israeli prime minister, Ehud Barak. He said in 2006, he said, when we entered Lebanon, there was no Hezbollah. We were accepted with perfume, rice, and flowers by the Shia in the South. It is our presence there that created Hezbollah. That's in Newsweek, 18th of July, 2006. Yitzhak Rabin, the late Prime Minister of Israel, told me the same thing in the 1980s. So basically, you have people who are making rational choices in terms of what they're doing.
Mm.
Are there people who don't like Hezbollah in Lebanon? God knows, yes. Are there people who'd like to be represented by another group? God knows, yes. But on the other hand, I don't think that the election results are shams. They are an accurate, more or less, representation of public sentiment.
Gitte Greenstein in Tel Aviv, how do you see it? Do you see Islamic democracy as an oxymoron? Do you see Hamas and Hezbollah as credible democratic representatives, even if you disagree with their policy?
I don't think that Islamic democracy is an oxymoron. In fact, I think that the Islamic groups have a grassroots constituency. They have platforms to communicate with their own publics. They have representatives that are elected or nominated in ways that galvanize a lot of popular support. And in fact, there are a lot of Islamic states where you see certain elements of democracy. So there is not an oxymoron there. In terms of Israel's ability or the ability of America to recognize or to support Hamas, I don't think it's even an issue. We're not expected to recognize Hamas. We're not expected to support Hamas. The question on the Israeli side is how to fight Hamas. And the dilemma is, do you fight Hamas using military means or economic boycotts, or do you fight Hamas by exposing their fallacies? Because you have a political party on the Palestinian side that on the one hand says that all agreements with Israel are null and void. And on the other hand, it expects Israel to continue to fulfill its obligations according to the existing agreements. And this is where you could highlight the tension in their policies, the internal contradictions, serving two masters, Palestinian national interest on the one hand and wider ideology of third parties on the other hand. And that's the big debate in Israel.
Ken Silverstein, there's the question for Israel, says Gitte Greenstein, how to fight Hamas. Is that the question for the United States? How to fight Hamas, or your article, I would say, suggests how to engage Hamas.
Well, you know, I do believe that we need to engage with Islamic groups, and I don't believe it's at all productive to simply shut them out of the debate. As I said earlier on this show, I think that the message we send by doing that, particularly as Professor Norton has laid out, when we encourage and insist that the Palestinians hold election and then reject the outcome, it's just it's not a good message to be sending to the Middle East. It basically, as I said earlier, dovetails with the Al-Qaeda message that democracy just doesn't matter and we don't care one bit about it. So I do believe that we need to engage with these movements. You know, the Iraq Study Group came out and suggested that we talk to Syria and Iran. And I believe it was James Baker, who was one of the co-chairs of the Iraq Study Group, who said that, you know, in his view, you always talk to your enemies, that there was no reason that we should not be engaging with other parties simply because we didn't share their perspective of things. And I think that that applies to Hamas and Hezbollah and the rest of these groups as well. I mean, in the case of the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, and the U.S. policy of not talking to the Brotherhood, that makes no sense at all. I just can't see it. I mean, there is absolutely no way that we can talk about reshaping Egypt along democratic lines without engaging with a movement that represents, as Professor Norton said, probably 30 to 50% of the population. It just can't happen. Mm. So I do believe we need to engage with these groups. That's we don't have to endorse what they say. We don't have to, you know, pat them on the back and say, you're wonderful. But we do need to try to understand what they represent and deal with them.
Let me go to Concord, Massachusetts. Jale, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I believe this argument is standing on its head. That is, it wasn't George Bush that one day decided that let's call democracy in the Middle East and then, oops, we got the wrong result.
Okay.
That's not what happened.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, it was the millions of masses in the Middle East, which is totally seems to be devoid in this argument, that have tried to find a means to decades of U.S. neocolonial designs in the Middle East and its, you know, resources that gave rise to the only potent means that could fight the American neocolonial designs.
So don't see this as Bush policy. This is a region's response to long-term policy, you're saying.
Exactly. And 30 years ago, it culminated in Iran overthrowing the American puppet in Iran. And it is the continuation of that and the inevitability of that victory of the masses, basically, that has made U.S. readjust this policy in the Middle East.
Jale, our time is short, but let us pick it up. Richard Norton in Kuwait, what about it? Maybe in that famous speech in November 2003, maybe George Bush was right. He said, you know, we can't have stability in the long run by embracing autocrats. We have to go to democracy in the Middle East. I mean, is it possible that he was right for all the instability that Giddy Greenstein points to that's come with it? Jale says, look, this is what the people there want. Can the U.S. embrace democracy long term and have both stability, you know, and a brighter future for this region?
Tom, I think that the fundamental critique of George Bush was correct, which is to say that it is a recipe for instability and violence to keep up to maintain these stagnant regimes. There needs to be reform. It was all about execution. It was all about how the policy was implemented. Unfortunately, the Bush administration seemed to act at times as though you would give one of these countries a couple of Thomas Jefferson aspirin on Thursday night, and on Friday morning everything would be fine. This is a long-term process. It requires patience and perseverance and, above all, a long-term perspective. And this administration has not distinguished itself, unfortunately, in its execution with that kind of long-term perspective.
Ken Silverstein, any sign that it may still happen, or is this an abandoned policy poll at this point?
Are you talking about the democracy end or the engagement?
Well, I guess it's a package or would be.
Well, in terms of promotion of democracy, I think pretty much all observers have concluded that the Bush administration has abandoned that policy. I mean, the strong showing of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egyptian elections, the victory by Hamas in the Palestinian elections, the absolute disaster still unfolding in Iraq, all of these have caused the administration to if it was ever at all serious about the policy, it has completely abandoned it at this point, and stability is once more right there in the driver's seat. In terms of engagement, I don't think there's much of a chance over the next 2 years while the Bush administration is in office that engagement is going to be pursued. I think it's up to a future administration.
So there's a snapshot in a very long story. We hope it lights up a little more than just today's news. Giddy Greenstein, we're going to have you back from Tel Aviv to walk us on in here. We're grateful to you for being with us today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
And Augustus Richard Norton, his new book Hezbollah comes out shortly. Look for it. Richard Norton, thank you for being with us today.
Tom, it's always a pleasure.
They're from Kuwait City, and Ken Silverstein in Washington at Harper's Magazine. Thanks very much for your time and work, Ken.
Thank you so much.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new 240-horsepower turbocharged Acura RDX. More at acura.com/RDX.